This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
True North stores have Primo Eats and Pepsi brand products that are heavy on taste and light on your wallet. Right now, buy any Primo sandwich and add a 20-ounce Pepsi brand beverage for just $1. Handmade every day, Primo uses quality meats and cheeses. Complete the meal with a Pepsi. Grab any Primo sandwich and pair it with a 20-ounce Pepsi brand beverage for just $1. Get more with the True Rewards mobile app. Available in your app store. True North convenience stores. Fast, friendly, clean.
The details behind the Diddy indictment. Taylor Swift's stalkers. Jerry Lee trying to kill Elvis. Disgraceland dives into the dark side of entertainment every Tuesday. Follow and listen to Disgraceland on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Mully and Haw, Chicago Sports Radio, 670 The Score. Are we the city of winners? What happened?
Good morning, Mully. Happy
We're
Friday.
We're all about the winning.
Oh, my gosh. It will be hard to top that.
I feel like the biggest winner here.
I feel like it was the best day ever, or at least in a very long time. How does that happen?
When's the last time that's happened?
I can't remember. I think we're going to have to chronicle that, look into the archives, because the Sox win. The Cubs win.
The Sox win?
The Bulls win. All three teams win at the same time in the same day.
How did the Bulls win that game?
Good question.
How in the heck did the Bulls win that
game? That's what LeBron was asking as he boarded the flight back to L.A. Losers.
Losers.
Because LeBron gave it away, too. And not only did he give it away, then Josh Giddey. Oh, my Giddey, Ant.
Oh, I got to tell you.
Oh, my Giddey, Ant.
That, who said it on the broadcast, I think? Like, thank you, Paul Patton. I mean, did he teach him the half-court heave?
Well, you can teach him to shoot better from three-point range. How you bank that or swish that from 47 feet away, that's just... Lots of practice.
He said he'd never done it before.
Little luck involved.
He'd hit shots at the end of games, but he'd never hit a buzzer beater.
Mully, not only had he not done that before, but that was the longest buzzer beater in Bulls history.
Is that true?
Yes.
Wow.
That was the longest buzzer beater in Bulls history is the way that it was being described. And boy, was it described well.
Is it 65 or 66? When did the Bulls start? 66? It's a long time.
Yes, and that sequence was one of the more remarkable sequences you'll ever see in a basketball game. It ended the way the Bulls wanted it to, the way that Josh Giddey once dreamed a game would.
Oh.
Every kid has shot a half-court heave in his mind, in his driveway, wherever, and Josh Giddey buried it from the logo.
You
Unbelievable.
Know, the Lakers had won that game. The Bulls were down like... almost 20, right? Was it 18 in the fourth quarter? And they came back.
Came back.
And they hit a buzzer beater to win the game. How in the – I mean, I get it. They're confident and they've been feeling good. They never quit. And they – Kobe wasn't having much of a night.
No.
And then he had a whole night in one quarter.
26 points, and he hit the shots in the clutch when he needed to.
Oh, my.
And The 9 points in the final 10 seconds or whatever it ended up being, when you saw Patrick Williams and then you saw Giddey steal the ball LeBron.
He compared it to Larry Bird.
Yeah.
Giddey steals the ball. Giddey steals Johnny Most came out of nowhere.
Yeah. And then he gets it to Kobe, who hits in the clutch. And then the defensive lapse and Austin Reeves goes down and you think, oh my gosh, this was all for naught. And 3 seconds left, and Josh Giddey did this.
So Doncic in play, far sideline, left forecourt. Doncic holding and looking at play to Reeves. Works on Williams to the rim, and the layup is good. 3.3 left. 117-116 Lakers. Williams to Giddey over the midcourt line. Good, it goes. Midcourt. Oh! It's good! It's good! It's good! Bulls win! Josh Giddey from midcourt from the Bulls logo. What a ball game. Unbelievable. Unbelievable. Josh Giddey, I love you.
Josh Giddey, I love you.
I got to tell you.
I love you, mate.
But that was the kind of moment where you hug someone you don't know.
Yes.
Oh, my God, did you know?
Strangers hugging strangers.
Get over here. Come in here for one.
Come in for a big one. You just felt like it was
unbelievable.
Unbelievable. Something you didn't expect to happen. It happens to other teams, other cities. Not Chicago.
Not after watching the White Sox won.
Oh, my gosh.
And then the Cubs winning, which was great. And
Cubs scored 10 runs?
How did they?
Could that be right?
The Flip Sox it around. Scored 8. How did that had to be wrong?
Which is more remarkable.
Which was smart.
You know what? Josh Giddey hits a 47-footer for the longest buzzer beater in team history, and yet it wasn't the most remarkable feat of the day because the Sox scored 8 runs.
It's so borderline mean, but I mean, it was glorious.
But it was a fun day.
It was a glorious day.
It's all in fun because everybody won.
And the NCAAs were phenomenal,
yes,
too.
They really were.
Great.
They delivered.
Your guy Cal getting
Cal gave up a 16-point lead.
They were like the Lakers.
You know, maybe we should have led with the college basketball.
College basketball
we
was real good.
We don't want to ignore college sports in Chicago.
No. God, you know what? I mean, I know we're a blue city.
I know. We don't want to do
or
that.
Or whatever it was.
But we digress.
Yeah, we got yelled at
yesterday.
Yeah, we did.
But back to the Giddey shot. It was great to hear Chuck go crazy. And you're right. That's a great way to put it. You wanted to hug a stranger. You just wanted to hug a stranger.
Anyone in your vicinity.
At the United Center. You know what? Stacey King needed a hug. This is how and Adam Amin sounded on CHSN.
So fun.
Doncic took the final shot before that. Here's Reeves. Reeves straight to the cup. Lays it in to take the lead. Bulls are out of timeouts. 2 seconds left. Giddey for the win. Go!
Oh, my God! I cannot believe this. Elizabeth, I'm coming, baby. Sydney or Melbourne, Paul Hogan, somebody there, Crocodile Dundee. Oh, Lord.
You may never see a wilder sequence than you just saw in the final 10 seconds. And Josh Giddey from down under beats the Lakers at the horn.
This is unbelievable. Bulls Nation, embrace this team. I'm telling you, the hype is real. This is not the same team. You better embrace them. Get your tickets. Buy them. This is a special team. A lot.
He started out. He went Fred Sanford.
Yeah.
He got into Crocodile Dundee.
Paul Hogan. Any Australian reference that came to Stacey's mind, he would say out loud. Melbourne.
Magic Giddey. Good day, mate.
Magic Giddey.
Somewhere in Australia, Sydney or Melbourne. Paul Hogan is somewhere in Crocodile Dundee.
Yeah.
And he hit from
Paul
down
Hogan
under.
Is the name of the actor who plays Crocodile.
What
Dundee.
A finish. What
hilarious.
A finish. And the place went nuts.
Oh, my God.
The Lakers.
Place went crazy.
Really blew it down the stretch. But when you hit a shot like that, you didn't. The Lakers didn't lose that game. The Bulls won it. They went out and they.
A lot of Laker fans in the crowd.
Yes.
And they looked crestfallen.
They did.
They were just.
There
as
was a
they
lot
should
of,
be.
It's their only trip to Chicago.
Yeah.
And
you just beat them half a week ago.
There were a lot of LeBron fans there and a lot of LeBron jerseys there. And you saw a lot of Luka people there. They were loved.
And you know now for certain that Mike is better than LeBron.
Yeah, of course, because of Josh Giddey. Bulls won.
Just underscored.
LeBron zero. That just gets another. Not
Josh Giddey. I love you.
I love you, Josh Giddey.
Now, honestly, when you burp out love for a man, that's a hell of a shot.
He handled it really well post game too. Josh Giddey has emerged as quite the spokesman for this team and saying how they're playing together. They're coming. They love this group. This Bulls team now 9 out of the last 11, 4 in a row. We talked to Billy Donovan the other day. This is a fun thing to watch. It feels like a very much a college tournament late season run type of thing.
Because they're all that age.
Exactly.
But I mean, did he have another triple-double, I believe?
Yes, he did.
I mean, that guy, he's really playing well. I got to tell you, maybe the play of the game was that steal. I mean, obviously it's the last second shot because it won the game. But I'm saying that was a huge play at that moment.
Yep, one led to the other.
And throwing it out to Kobe, who knocks down a three. That was a big moment in that game. And, you know, identify the man least likely to make the big game steal. I thought coming into the year that wasn't his skill. I thought for half the season that wasn't his skill. He's doing things that you don't anticipate he can do.
He had 8 steals last Saturday night against the Lakers. He has the big one down the stretch against LeBron, who looked all of 40 years old. He looked rusty last
LeBron
night.
LeBron was aging in front of us.
1-12 from 3-point range since he's come back from the groin injury.
He got older quarter to quarter.
He did seem to be aging. Looked like he didn't start the game looking with gray hair or specs,
yeah, exactly.
But he did it by the end of the game. And that'll age you. When you lose a game like that, that will age somebody. And the Bulls just keep playing together. They keep playing well. And what a ending to a great day in Chicago sports. And there aren't very many days like yesterday.
No, it was, I mean, you did kind of lose your own sense of identity. Are we winners? I thought we were the city of losers. How did this happen? It was phenomenal. They have won, what is it, 9 of 11 now?
Yes.
The Bulls?
Mm-hmm.
Man, twice the Lakers in that group.
It's great that at least the conversation has shifted from the tankathon.com standings watch to you believe how well this team is playing together, moving the basketball, playing unselfishly, doing what needs to be done in the clutch, and identifying guys who want to be part of this core. Matas, Josh Giddey, Kobe White.
Kevin Huerter had like the game of his life.
He did.
Matas even said it on his IG. He said the Bulls are back.
Did he say
yes,
that?
Yes, he did.
Well, you can forgive him for getting a little carried away.
Yeah, he's such a fun guy.
You know,
guy.
He is fun. And the Bulls, enjoy this because maybe the Bulls are back. It's something to consider. It's not ridiculous. You need to do more longer. But
well, I'll tell you
I understand the sentiment.
We're going to the game on Saturday.
Yes, we are.
No duckouts, okay? No Irish goodbyes.
No.
You got to stay there till they throw in
especially
the last shot. Exactly.
If they're down 15 in the fourth. I don't want to see you leaving for the door.
The final heave.
You're staying for every last possession, buddy.
Holy guacamole. That was, I mean, honestly, that was, that you got the goosebumps. You don't see that. You don't see, that. You know, you. In fact, I was kind of like, Stacy, you hear him say, I told you. Meaning Austin Reeves driving to the bucket. He did that twice at the end of the game, and you were like, don't give up points that easily.
Austin Reeves took over that game in the second quarter.
Oh, man.
He was unstoppable. Then he gets the big shot down the stretch. Two nights in a row, I think it's interesting from the Lakers' perspective. Luka takes the last shot in Indianapolis. LeBron was there to tip it in.
LeBron tipped it
in. And last night, Austin Reeves takes the shot, the final possession for the Lakers. Doesn't matter because Josh Giddey made it moot. But in both cases, LeBron wasn't that guy.
Interesting.
Wasn't that guy to take the last shot.
He was the tip-in artist.
All cases. Like LeBron lost it. I mean, the Patrick Williams three, he was defending that. Then a lazy inbound pass. And then he was kind of defending Giddey on that half-court shot.
Kind of. Kind of in retreat.
Yeah, he's got to get back. He's getting older.
That was the kind of.
I love that. I thought it was so great.
The kind of buzzer beater, though, you usually see in March, but not from the NBA.
Exactly. Exactly.
That was a college tournament game.
That was the best game of the college tournament.
It was last night. What's the average age of the Bulls versus the average age of Oklahoma, of Texas Tech?
Well, LeBron, I mean, his age kind of really raises the bar. Let's be honest.
What, for the Lakers,
46 now?
47? He looked it in the final minute.
As I'm saying, as the game went on, he started the game. He was still
there was the Jordan statue in the atrium, and then there was the LeBron statue on the court.
Oh, that's beautiful. Let's take some gratuitous shots.
Well, you know, the Bulls sent him home a loser.
They have the right. They have the right.
And, Molly, it felt different. It felt, like you said, almost euphoric because it was a day full of unexpected glee in Chicago.
Yes.
So the White Sox game was fantastic.
I got to tell you, I mean, I was blown away by that game. I just, you know, Sean Burke, what a performance.
What a performance.
Way to go. That was a great job. They got three home runs. This home run challenge team, we complained, there's no power. They got Slater hit a solo shot.
Comet was on strike for the White Sox.
Benintendi with the broken bone in his hand.
A Betty bomb.
He hit a Betty bomb, and it was a three-run homer. And then Lidín Sosa, not to be outdone, had a two-run homer.
Well,
they hit him.
Those were no doubters.
Those were gone.
Those were no doubters. Andrew Benintendi, very quietly, has returned from a broken hand.
Dealing with some pain, yeah.
Has to be playing through some pain. He homers on opening day. We didn't even think he would be around opening day.
I know.
Sean Burke does a very nice Garrett Crochet imitation.
He what? I couldn't believe how well he pitched,
It made me think of last year.
Six innings, three hits.
Remember last year we wondered how far Crochet would go in the game, and we thought three innings, four innings, and he ends up going six on opening day. This sounds almost absurd to compare what Sean Burke did to Crochet and had the expectation that's going to follow this season. But he was very strong, and I think he overcame some early jitters maybe of being the opening day starter and really settled down nicely.
I believe they were up 3-0 in the eighth inning, and it was first and third. And the manager of all people, goes to the bullpen, brings in Mike Clevinger, who proceeds to walk. I thought that was a good thing to do, frankly. Don't let that guy beat you. Mike Trout, he got the bases loaded, and he gets him out of the jam. That's a really good decision to go to your high leverage guy
at that time.
If
Mike Clevinger is your high leverage guy, and I think that he is for the Sox,
I agree.
Then moving to him at that moment was a smart decision.
And that's Will Venable, and that's a different level of managing than we saw a year ago.
I think you're right. It's a good call. It's also refreshing to see that happen in the first game of the season. It bodes well for the future and decisions like that. Unconventional? Maybe not anymore. I think when you go to your best relief pitcher,
do it in the biggest moment.
You don't want to squander that opportunity to put out that rally. That's right. Clevinger did.
He did well. I mean,
hey, by the way, I wish love having Alex Kuhn here today. MVP returns.
Yes.
We can't call me the MVP today because I kept saying that the Cubs are 1-0.
That's okay.
Yeah.
You're forgiven. I wasn't going to bring attention to that. It's okay. You get past
my bad, guys.
That's okay. It's a first quarter miss. Don't worry.
We don't count those games either.
I almost wish Dustin was here for this reason. Mike Trout was not only in right field yesterday, he was at the Bulls game.
Yeah. He apparently is good buddies with Zach LaVine, of all people.
Yes.
So maybe he thought Zach was still with the Bulls.
I don't know.
I'm Mike Trout.
He was not eating a Subway. I did see him there with some friends and an entourage. But Mike Trout was there courtside to see the Bulls and the Lakers.
Weren't the White Sox in a booth? Didn't the White Sox get like a nice little place upstairs? They're off today.
Yeah.
You know, and I believe they were in, I don't know if it was Jerry's suite, but they were in a suite.
I'm sure they probably did that because it was a marquee event. The Lakers, again, come to town once a season. And it's the traveling road show. When you got LeBron and Luka, it's a spectacle. It's an attraction. And they went home defeated.
They lost. Those losers left like with the big L on their shirt. It's probably for
LA losers.
Yeah.
The LA losers left.
That's right. Take that.
Take that. So Sox win, Bulls win, and then after everybody was coming down from their euphoric experience throughout the rest of the day, the Cubs score 10 in Arizona.
Yeah, that was awesome.
They scored 10 runs.
They did. They did indeed.
Who said anything about jet lag?
Your guy Ian Happ. Who said move him down in the order? Let him keep raking.
It's a fair question. But yeah, Ian Happ definitely he went deep, and I don't think that Justin Steele was necessarily overly sharp, but he'll take the.
Well, I'll tell you what. He was sharper than Zach Gallen.
Zach Gallen.
He was walking guys, man. That was there was a lot of really mediocre performance from a guy who is as good as him, all-star pitcher.
Good to see Miguel Amaya have a big hit.
Yes, he did.
Nice to see some things happen. I like the batting order. We'll talk about it with Matt Shaw moved down. It was just like a lot to like about everything yesterday. Where are we?
Yeah. No, it was something, I got to tell you. Sox actually did not play a bad defensive game. I mean, they were good, and they had a couple of moments in that game. I'm just saying, I don't think I expected that at all. I think that was the most surprising one. Obviously, a guy hitting a mid-court shot at the buzzer was the most exciting
moment.
That
speaks to how low your expectations were of the White Sox.
Oh, when my gosh.
The Bulls hit a 47-footer for the first buzzer beater in team history, and the biggest surprise of your day was that the White Sox looked fundamentally sound in beating.
They look well managed. I'm just saying, they didn't look as overwhelmed as I imagine they would be or are. That was a...
They did not.
They got good pitching.
Right.
They got good pitching. Through the bullpen, too.
Day off today because the weather... built in their off day. That was smart. Wasn't so smart maybe starting the season in Chicago against the Los Angeles team in March.
I'll take it.
But you'll take it now. They have the day off today, then they get back at it tomorrow and Sunday.
What are the Angels called these days? Are they no longer the
bad.
California Angels? Are they
They're bad.
Are they the Anaheim Angels?
The Los Angeles Angels of Anaheim.
Are they still the Los Angeles Angels of Anaheim?
I believe so.
Yeah, that's a little wordy.
TA got a nice ovation. Tim Anderson.
You know what? I got to tell you, that was great.
Mm-hmm.
TA, you know what? I loved the dichotomy of the receptions. TA gets the great reception.
Mm-hmm.
And then Moncada comes in and he just gets booed, and he sadly has earned it. And then Nicky Lopez comes in and he literally gets laughed at because he's pitching. They had to pitch Nicky Lopez.
Well, he has to earn his roster spot.
There was like happiness, there was laughter, there was joy, and there was booing.
Well, there are a lot of different degrees of relevance there, and what Tim Anderson meant to the South Side, much different than what Yoan Moncada represented, and certainly Nicky Lopez, with due respect.
Yeah.
Nicky Lopez, the pride of Naperville.
Yeah, local guy made good.
Yoan Moncada, it was the epitome of underachievement.
He was, and he heard it.
And Tim Anderson really represented the Sox as well as anybody could when they were good, because he was the face of baseball, as Joe Buck said, or he wanted to be. But he was the bat flip mentality guy. He was the guy that was the leader in many ways of some teams that didn't accomplish what they wanted.
Did you see?
But it was a nice ovation.
The Ozzie Moncada thing. Chuck took a photo.
Yeah.
Of that was hysterical. Because Ozzie is just talking as he does, and it looked like Moncada was going in for one.
Yeah,
it was such
weird. Yeah, it was funny. It was funny.
Wait a minute.
Ozzie did a lot of talking yesterday. I tell you, I was out there for the new studios.
Did you go out there
for CHSN?
Oh,
and they unveiled the new studios where they do the pre and post game show.
Yeah. They look
it's
great.
It's really nice.
You're overlooking.
Yeah.
Even the bench looked super
It's really cool.
Yeah.
And it was a nice crowd out there. So, all in all.
How long did you stay?
I stayed probably.
Did you go see Layla and Marshall? Oh,
yes.
Good.
Yes. I made the rounds yesterday, Molly, because you got me going thinking the wings and rings. So, I went from wings and rings to the ballpark and then took a little bit of a respite, and then I caught the first quarter of the Bulls-Lakers game, but I left.
Oh, that's great, though. That's wonderful.
It was fun because it was one of those days. It doesn't happen
energy.
Often.
Yeah.
And certainly yesterday, we're going to have to find out the last time the Bulls, the Sox, and the Cubs all won the same day.
It was the first home opener win for the Sox since like 2014.
In over a decade. It was historic. It was euphoric. It was fun.
It was great.
It was great to have fun.
It was a great day.
Watching Chicago sports.
You're so right. It was great to have positive results from Chicago sports teams. It's just been a while. Mully and Haw, Chicago Sports Radio 670, The Score.
Oh, I love Chuck.
Yeah, it's hysterical. Hard to play there, you know, that thin air.
Oh,
and
yeah.
We are delighted to welcome in the head coach of the Chicago Bulls, doing a remarkable job. Billy Donovan joins us on the Aturo Tire Hotline. Aturo, your hometown tire, aturo.com. Good morning, coach. How are you?
I'm doing great, guys. How are you doing?
Doing well.
I got to tell you, we are really having fun watching your team. And the way that you play, the way that, I heard Malone saying after the game, I heard him say it before the game, that you guys are maybe the best running team in the NBA. And that is a real compliment for a guy that plays out west and tries to run people off the court sometimes when he can with that thin air.
Well, Mike and I go back a long way. We actually grew up in the same neighborhood, knew his father really well, and we've had a very, very close relationship and, you know, appreciate the kind words. But, you know, I think one of the things that we said, you know, to start the season was we had to play that way. And we talked about it, you know, in the training camp media day. I think I made the comment, if we don't run, we're done, you know, and I think the guys deserve a lot of credit. You know, we totally changed stylistically the way we were kind of playing in the past because I think our personnel changed. So guys did a great job coming back in shape. I thought the 3 weeks leading up to the start of training camp, you know, everybody came in. We really started to try to play that way when these guys played a lot of pickup ball. We played with a 14-second shot clock for most of the preseason. I think that kind of set a foundation for us. And then, you know, we've been able to stay consistent with it, and the guys have really done a good job of trying to night in and night out play to that identity.
You know, Billy, I think that it's obvious to see the evidence of your coaching on the way your team has played, whether it's the last 10 games or really since the Zach LaVine trade, but I think it's there. And we have kidded about, well, you know what, even despite your record, you could be a candidate for the coach of the year. And I know you're not going to acknowledge that, and I know that you're not going to be in on that conversation, but I do wonder if you take a step back, how would you describe, you changed the style, you changed the approach, you changed the pace. So how would you describe the overall impact that you've had as a coach on this team compared to previous seasons in Chicago?
Yeah, I mean, I think every season is always a little bit different, you know, and there's certainly, since I've been here, you know, a lot of change, quite honestly. And I know the Lonzo Ball injury, you know, in my second year, you know, that kind of altered things. And I know that we kind of played for a period of time, you know, without a point guard. I thought Io came in as a rookie when we lost Caruso and we lost Lonzo and really did a remarkable job. But, you know, I look at the way the teams have changed and the way we flowed. And, you know, I think when you come in at this level, you know, whatever, you're certainly going to have philosophical beliefs in terms of the way the game's played. But you are, in a lot of ways, I think, responsible to try to play in a way that really magnifies, puts guys in position to do what they do well. I love DeMar DeRozan. You know, he was one of the best closers that I've ever had a chance to coach. You know, I think Zach LaVine has been one of the most gifted scorers I've ever had a chance to coach. Vooch is a very, very smart player. And, you know, I think earlier on, you know, we tried to play to those guys' strengths in a lot of ways. And then with some of our point guard situation being in flux, you know, I didn't think that the best thing for our team was to kind of play that way. So you know, Zach's always been a great transition player. He's always been up there as one of the league leaders scoring in transition. He's tremendous in that area. And I give the guys a lot of credit because when you start this journey going into the season, it starts well before training camp. You know, you go out, you meet with players, guys get together, and you start to talk about the season, the identity, and how we need to play. And I give the guys a lot of credit. They were all bought in and believed that this is what we had to do to be successful and how we needed to play. So I think from that standpoint, I always say at this level, there's voluntary cooperation. Everybody's got to work together. And this has been a great group to work with. I enjoyed working with all the groups here in Chicago. All the guys I've had a chance to work with have been great guys. And I feel like I've really, really tried to do the best job that they can to play in a way that we needed to play.
I don't want to just sit here and keep complimenting you, but I think one of the most remarkable aspects about watching this season has been sort of with three players in particular that are playing so differently now than they did earlier in the year. And you know, obviously, Kobe has emerged. He's playing now like he's an all-star player. I don't know if there's another level for him, and there could be, but he's playing like he belongs in an all-star game. Josh Giddey is playing a complete and all-around game as well as anybody, and I'm not sure we were seeing that before. And then Matas is another example of a guy who you didn't give a ton of minutes to, who you kind of made earn his minutes. He wasn't involved late in games, and you've created this confidence in all three of those players that has changed the way that they're playing the game. And I think it's by holding them accountable and by, you know, kind of especially maybe with Giddey and Matas, and then helping. Helping Kobe become the player he is. I feel there's a confidence to this group that was not there earlier in the year.
Yeah, I mean, I think a little bit is that's accurate. You know, one of the things that, you know, when I first came here and Larry Marketing was here and Wendell Carter was here and Kobe was here, you know, I think when those guys are high draft picks, there's this perception or feeling that these guys are going to be the future. And what ends up happening is these guys get put into leadership roles and responsibilities that they are not equipped or capable of handling at their age. And, you know, I had this conversation with Kobe in the summer, and he, every year I've been with him, I feel like every year has taken a step. And it's really a great credit to him that whatever is thrown at him, he always looks at internally of how he can be better. He's never been an excuse maker or point fingers or cast blame. And his role has changed quite a bit for us. But I had this conversation with Kobe. I had it with Io, and I had it with Patrick Williams, just because these guys were going into their fourth, fifth, sixth years as NBA players. And I said, there comes a point in time in all your guys' career, you know, as starters, that the leadership responsibility falls on your shoulders. And you guys are in a position right now that you have enough experience. What you're going to be judged and evaluated on is how well can you lead. It's not only about your own individual performance, but it's how well can you lead through your experiences. And I think you probably last year started to see Kobe's voice emerge. You started to see Io's voice emerge. And I think even Patrick Williams, you know, tried to do that. All three of them have been great team guys. All three of those guys really, really want to win. And I think that they've got a really good understanding that it takes everybody. And it takes chemistry. And it takes cohesiveness. And it takes everybody being on the same page. And not only has Kobe played at an incredible level, a lot of people don't get a chance to see and hear what goes on inside the locker room, huddles, and practice. He has been a phenomenal leader. And I think one of the most powerful things that ends up happening, you know, during the course of the season is belief. I thought DeMar last year, quite honestly, when we had a lot of injuries and we lost players like Zach and Patrick for the rest of the season, DeMar was a guy that gave the group great belief that we could win. And I think Kobe's done the same thing. I think some of these players learn things from different players. But those guys have done a remarkable job leading. You know, as it relates to Modest, I think one of the things that has happened for him, when you've got a player, and he's really talented, and I think everybody can see the talent level, but sometimes he doesn't, early on, didn't understand how hard he needed to compete and play on a nightly basis. And he just, a lot of times, was able to ramp up his talent, and that was good enough as a younger player. Well, the talent level's evened out right now. And the biggest thing I've told him is the three things he needs to be accountable to, you know, every day is toughness, intensity, and his energy. If he does that, his talent, you know, will come out. If he doesn't play like that, you start to see a lack of strength, a lack of experience, you know, and a lack of sometimes understanding of who he's guarding, personnel, and those kind of things. So he's done a good job of, when you do hold him accountable, when you do get on him, he doesn't pout. He takes it. He tries to get better from it. And as a young player, I give Modest a lot of credit. I've been around a lot of young players. When there's any level of criticism or there's any level of, you know, taking a guy out of the game, there can be pouting. There can be not understanding. Modest uses mistakes and adversity as a way to try to get better. And this was one of the things I had talked about earlier in the year with him, this idea of player development and develop them. And they think we'll just throw the guy out there and let him play. That's how you develop. The best part about us right now is for Modest is we're in meaningful games, you know, in terms of trying to play after the end of the regular season. So instead of just going into the rest of the season with nothing on the line, we'll just give him minutes. That doesn't work. He needs to, you know, he hit a little bit of the rookie wall. He needed how to figure out how to get through that. You know, he's gone through different things that he's needed to learn about how to improve. And I do think from a player development standpoint, yes, between the lines is important. But there's a lot of other things that impact what goes on in between the lines besides just playing time. And I give Modest a lot of credit that he's totally embraced that and has taken that on. I think as it relates to Josh Giddey, you know, Josh, I think coming in with leaving Australia, coming to the United States, playing in Oklahoma City, coming here, there was a lot of uncertainty, and he needed some period of time to adjust to the players he was playing with. And we've gone through a lot of injuries this year as well. But Josh, I think, has gotten into a situation where he really understands things that he needs to do to impact our group and help our team.
I think we've all been impressed by how you've been able to keep the focus on the main thing every night and not get caught up in all the noise surrounding what this season represents to the Bulls. And I just wonder, in that context, Billy, with 10 games to go, after having a really successful 10-game stretch, 8-2 in that span, you kind of have changed things with the way that you've incorporated Herter, and Trey Jones was great before the injury, and Zach Collins has been a revelation. How has that changed or reset your goals for this season? Has it, if you, in fact, have played well enough to now kind of look at this season in a different way?
Yeah, there's no question. Those three guys coming in here helped our team immensely. Zach Collins has brought in a lot of physical toughness and size, rim protection. He's very, very good in pick and roll coverage. Herter is a really, really high IQ player. I really have always liked him as a player, even when he was in Atlanta and at Sacramento. He's got a really good feel how to play. He's more than just a catch and shoot guy. He can make plays and has had a cut and read. He's very smart. And Trey Jones, I think I've been pretty outspoken about him. He just, there's a lot of things and intangible things he brings to the table. So I think with the way we were playing stylistically, those three guys fit in very, very well to how we were playing. And I think going forward, you know, the one thing, and I know a lot of people have a lot of different opinions of what we should or shouldn't do, you know, as it relates to the draft, free agency, I get that. But there's something really, really powerful in players that are younger. At some point in their career, they've got to impact winning. And even though, you know, where we're at right now as a team, you know, we're in the play-in, but we're still kind of at the bottom, you know, of the Eastern Conference. But the reality is we have a chance to play meaningful games, and that's going to help Modest. It's not just like, hey, the regular season's over with, we're not playing for anything, let's just roll him out there for 35 minutes and just see what the guy can do. And now what happens is the focus gets taken off the result of winning. Now, I think the results of winning are a byproduct of the things that you do for 48 minutes. And you've got to understand every possession's important. Paying attention to scouting reports are important. You know, the game plan discipline is important. So I think the one thing we've tried to do all season long is to make the point that all these games are important. And let's see what this group can do if we're fortunate enough after April 13th to be in a situation that we're playing after the regular season's over with. Those things are meaningful. That really, really plays a major factor, I think, in player development. And it also puts these guys in situations that they haven't been in before. And I think when you take the focus off of winning, you miss, I think, a big point of what's going to happen in the future. At some point, these guys are going to be put into a situation where now the winning becomes important. You want to make a run. And if they don't play in these meaningful games, I think it hurts their development. So what we've tried to do as a team, to your point of whatever the perception is of what or how the season should go, we in the locker room have kept it on, let's see how good we can be as a team. Let's go all in to become as good as we can be. And then whenever the season's finished up, hopefully it's something we can build upon going into the next season.
Great stuff, Billy. Really appreciate your time. Thanks for jumping on with us. And you're a really fun team to watch.
Yeah.
It's been
loads of
fun.
It really is enjoyable.
I really have enjoyed these guys. I appreciate the way they've worked and the way they've tried to play and sacrifice for one another. And, you know, we'll see how these next 10 games go, you know, come off a road trip, you know, playing tomorrow against the Lakers and then Dallas and back on the road again. So, you know, we still got a lot of challenges in front of us, but hopefully we can continue to evolve and grow as a team.
Thanks for coming on.
Appreciate it, Coach.
Thank you, guys. Appreciate it.
That is Billy Donovan.
The Brand Biggs. Biggs time. Biggs. With Mully and Haw. Biggs time. The Biggs Report. With Brad Biggs. Biggs time. Biggsy. His name is Brad Biggs. Brad Biggs talks football with you.
Mully and Haw, Chicago Sports Radio 670, The Score. Brad Biggs is the football man of the Chicago Tribune, longtime contributor to the station and a valued and well-loved friend. And he joins us on the Aturo Tire Hotline. Aturo, your hometown tire, Aturo.com. Biggs A!
Morning, Brad.
Morning, boys. What's going on?
Well, you're very popular, and like you have a texter saying quite literally, I laugh out loud every time you play the Robot Biggs, and you know, compliments on everything you do. Can you ask Biggsy what happened to his Missouri Tigers in the NCAA tournament? People know too much about you.
Yeah, they were bad the last couple of weeks. I watched a couple minutes of the game. That was it. I, you know, they were so bad. Of the finish line this season that had no expectations, but to go from winless in the SEC a year ago to making the tournament, that's fine. We'll move on.
We will move on. So Brad, obviously we're reading your draft and we're going over 1.0, and let's be honest about it. The reality is that's your first bite at the apple, right? How many drafts will you do? You will do one right before the draft in April. I know that.
Yeah, I mean, there'll be a couple more, at least two more, probably, on. I mean, one guy texted me, he's like, hey, you get, is this based on something you know?
You know stuff, Brad? I mean, you know stuff?
I'm like, blind guess, bro. Blind guess.
But, Brad, I think it's interesting, though, because you have Will Campbell going to the Bears at 10. And I'm curious, like, based on the people you talk to around the league, is there a building consensus that the first tackle off the board will be Armon Membu from Missouri because of the way he tested and just because of how he has begun to rise?
Well, I think, you know, I think there's a couple of factors that go in there. Like Mimbu, I don't think you can play him at left tackle.
Right.
And I don't think you'd probably want to try. Like, I remember talking to people about him back in, late September, early October. They liked him. They wanted to look at him some more. They thought he might be a guard. Now, I think people feel pretty good about him playing right tackle. But I think it depends a little bit what you need. Like, if you need two tackles, yeah, you could take him and plug him in there. But he's popular right now, and you know, as one GM told me at the combine, he said that offensive linemen in the draft in round one aren't much different than quarterbacks from the standpoint that they get overdrafted because everybody needs them. Like, of the 32 teams right now, how many are sitting there and they're saying, oh, yeah, we're good on the O-line? Like, that's a small handful of teams going into the draft every year, whether they actively try to get one in the first couple rounds. You know, that's not always the case, but everybody is always hunting offensive linemen.
Yeah, there's truth in that, and the Bears could, you know, obviously you want them to keep going. I wonder, is it fair to ask if Will Campbell can play left tackle in the NFL?
That's a good question, and it's a fair question, and people have you know, said, well, what about the arm length? And
right.
Fair question, right? But, boy, you watch him do it at LSU, and it sure looks like he can do it, right? You're not projecting a guy from a small conference that played, had a big game against Mississippi State, and then they played, Rutgers, and those were the two big teams on the schedule that they played. This is a guy who played at an elite level for a while. He's not a one-year starter. So I think if you're drafting him, chances are you're starting him at left tackle and you see what it looks like anyway, right? And,
right. You would have to do that if you take him at 10.
And it's like in a lot of these people that talk about, well, you know, his arm length is an issue, are ignoring the fact that there's been some pretty damn good linemen with shorter arms than you would like that have played left tackle in the last, 20 or 30 years in the NFL.
I tend to agree with that, Brad. I think it's an interesting choice, and if he fell to them, they'd be lucky probably to draft him. I also wonder this. In your mock draft, you have Ashton Jeanty going 12 to the Cowboys. How difficult, if that is indeed the case, would it be in your mind, based on who you've talked to, for Ben Johnson to pass on a running back that would give him a dynamic weapon in the backfield?
Yeah, I'm not going to pretend to know how Ben Johnson feels about Jeanty or his desire to build up that position, but that's got to come down to a number of factors. One, how special is this guy? Like, there's a little bit of recency bias here because, you know, folks are just the greatest running back that's come along in a long, long time. He's a really good player. There's no question about that. I would think the loud and proud crowd that wanted them to focus on the offensive line in the offseason would probably want them to stick with that in the draft, right? Yeah. Or do we have some flip meet flop where they're going to change their tune, and then if the line isn't fixed for the long haul, they're going to be back again saying these people were idiots that everybody knew they needed to fix the line, because Drew Dolman looks like a guy who can take care of your center position for this season and hopefully quite a while to come. Tooney, that's a shorter term fix,
yes.
And Jonah Jackson, they've got a lot of faith in, and if you're believing in the coach, you're trusting them there.
But he needs to bounce back, and you've got the question mark at left tackle. So you can't go wrong continuing to build the line. You know, the Lions didn't get their fancy toy at the running back position until they had, you know, really built up the structure and the backbone of that roster.
That's a good way of putting it. And I, as I have said many times, I have no problem drafting line of scrimmage at number 10, at 39, at 41. And maybe not all offensive linemen, but there are two sides to the line of scrimmage. I know they've improved through free agency, but I don't believe they're done there either.
Yeah, and the other thing, too, is that gets lost in this discussion about Jeanty at 10 that I think you know, some people just kind of ignore. It's a fantastic draft for running backs. It's not a good draft for running backs. It's a great draft. So that being said, like, are you at the point in your program where you can take a running back 10th overall, where you can draft a running back in the first round for the first time since Cedric Benson, which was 2 decades ago? Are they at that point in their program? I don't know that a foray in a free agency, understanding that they've got some players with really strong track records, high marks and on the field, in the locker room, but we tend to get kind of blinded by some of these moves in free agency where we expect them in March and April to be more impactful than they wind up being in October and in November. So are they at that point where they can pull the trigger on a running back that high in the draft?
Brad, I love the top 10, but very curious. The same question kind of applies to Tyler Warren, who you have going 7 to the Jets. That's very high for a tight end unless you're convinced that he's one of these guys that makes your offense instantly dangerous.
Yeah, I think Tyler Warren's interesting because he can impact every down. Right, like he's fantastic in the passing game. He's going to do everything he's called upon and more in the running game. I mean, he's a guy you can't dismiss from any conversation about the Bears at number 10, right? Because he's that total package at the tight end position, which I think is kind of, you know, what the Bears like. I think they'll get away from, you know, going for this one-dimensional guy, a Jimmy Graham type, a Gerald Everett, guys of that type. I think they're looking for players that can do it all. And, you know, I don't know what the chances are would be for him, but you'd need to have a conversation about him at 10. I think he's a really good player.
You know, I mean, I don't think it's for 10, but whoever winds up with Omarion Hampton, it's like you're drafting Derrick Henry. I mean, you see the size of this guy and the athletic ability and the strength. I mean, he's like a man.
Wow.
Yeah, he probably goes round one.
Yes.
That's your second. That's your second running back that's taken, and you know. Maybe the Bears are looking at him in a scenario and where there's a trade down.
Right.
I think they probably need to resist the urge to trade up with these three. You're in a really good spot right here.
You don't want
to
trade up, right?
Picks. Yeah. Well, you got 3 picks in the top 41.
Yes.
Just you know, be confident in the process you've put in place to stack your draft board, right, and arrange it, and then attack it, right, and then go get it, and keep your draft capital where it's at.
Brad, I just wonder if you're attaching any significance to the fact that Ben Johnson shows up at a Hawks game and they score a touchdown and win 7-4.
He did. He had.
It's an offense.
The Hawks are totally irrelevant, brother.
Oh,
that's
nice.
It's completely irrelevant.
They won yesterday, Brad. Bedard's hot.
Win, lose, or draw, they are irrelevant.
Ben Johnson begs to differ, and he was there. All right, good stuff, Biggsy.
Yeah.
Love the mock draft.
Good talk, anybody. The mock draft is tons of fun. I wonder if more quarterbacks will be taken than you imagine. You know, there's a lot of talk about Jackson Dart moving up. You know, no one would have picked Denver to jump in and take their quarterback, and it happened. And I think there could be a run on the bank, as we always know. Everybody needs a quarterback.
The Steelers need to get involved somehow because they're still trying to move on from Ben Roethlisberger, and maybe Aaron Rodgers lands there. But even if Rodgers does, you've got to
there is next year.
You've got to come up with a solution for that position.
There's always a year after you get a 40-year-old quarterback. Great stuff, Big Z.
See, Brad.
If Rodgers goes to the Steelers, the Bears do have Pittsburgh on the schedule this season.
Yeah, they come to town, I believe.
And have a great day, guys.
All right, he owns them.
He owns them.
Well, he may not own them
anymore.
I don't know. With that group. Maybe.
Maybe just.
He'll make the Steelers better if he goes there.
He would.
He would make the Steelers
they need a
definitely feel like they have a chance to return to the playoffs.
John, good morning. How are you?
Good morning. I like that. I'm not literally with Cam Smith at the moment. It's 7 a.m., but later.
But John, it's a fair question. Bigger story, Cam Smith or Juan Soto?
Well, one's $765 million. The other is about $765,000. So, you know, I'm all about money. So
follow the money. That's the measure of a true journalist. Okay, so it's the opening day. We keep calling it the domestic opening day because of the series in Japan. But this is it. Finally, the baseball season begins in earnest, and everybody excited. Let's start with your picks, John. Who's winning the World Series? Who did you like when you finally sat down and started measuring it up?
Well, you know, I go with the same team every year. I'm very boring, and I can't really go away from the Dodgers this year, can I? I mean, they have an all-time great team. So, you know, I went with the Dodgers over the Red Sox this year. American League is really, really wide open. It is, I mean, to be frank, rather weak. I would say the best six teams are in the National League. And the National League is good beyond six teams. I think there are probably 10 or 11 good teams in the National League. It's weird. I think some of it has to do with the free agent migration. Others, probably injuries is a factor, but National League far better, and they have the best team, at least on paper, that I can ever remember.
So let's stay in the National League, John, because the Cubs want to be one of those six teams. They want to be back in the playoffs. I feel like the tone on the north side with Jed Hoyer entering the final year of his deal with Kyle Tucker, maybe a one-year rental, there's a playoffs or bust feeling and vibe to this season for the Cubs. Do you agree?
Absolutely, right. Kyle Tucker is a rental, 1 year. We knew they weren't going to sign him. They knew they weren't going to sign him yet, maybe after the year, but he's a rental. Jed Hoyer, you're right, last year of his deal. They are the favorites in that division. I think they're going to win that division, but it's pretty wide open. I mean, the Reds with Terry Francona now, they're a threat. The Brewers are always a threat. Pirates have schemes. So it's not a given. I mean, the Cubs are a good team, but they can be beaten, I believe.
Yeah, I think that's interesting. You know, I was saying to David, we keep looking at it thinking that the Cubs have, you know, the great manager. They've got a lot of players that are going to be coming up and it's starting. And then you look at the rest of the division and who's made big moves, right? In fact, everybody, you know, the Brewers certainly took a step back. The problem is, I was telling him, I'm reading all this Red stuff yesterday, and I'm kind of like, how come I haven't looked at them and thought about their development as a young team getting better?
Right. I mean, they're a complete wild card, no pun intended. I mean, they could be great or they could be terrible. I don't think they'll be terrible, really, because they have Francona. I thought that was a very impactful move. He laid down the law right away. He demoted some guys who were kind of getting away with some stuff in the previous regime. And, you know, there's accountability now with the Reds, but they are very, very young. So, I mean, I think it's going to be a bit of a surprise if they do win that division. I see they seem to be a popular pick. I do favor the Cubs. I do think the Cubs are a little bit more solid team. Their pitching is more solid. You know, Tucker was a nice add. I think their defense overall is very good. I think Pete Crow Armstrong is rising. I don't know if he's ready to be an all-star, but he's getting better. I think the team is understandably the favorite in that. The Reds are a popular pick, but I don't quite see it at this point for them.
It's much too early to be wondering about trades, but I feel like during the spring training phase, Dylan Cease's that speculation surrounding him was as high as any player maybe in baseball because of what he could mean to a staff like the Yankees or wherever he may go. The Cubs were even linked at one point in time. Is that the first big domino to fall, the guy to keep an eye on the most, John, throughout baseball? Because his name has been linked to trade rumors for several months now.
Yeah, I think so. The Padres clearly did not want to trade him, at least the baseball ops people didn't. The ownership there is kind of in flux right now, and it's kind of putting it kindly. And, you know, they're a team that is a good team, but now with Darvish out, you know, there's questions in their rotation and in that division. It's going to be tough. So I would say when we get close to the deadline, that's one of the names that could be out there, providing that the Padres are not contending, which is very possible in the National League. I know they've got Merrill, Machado, Tatis, they've got some great players, but you know, I mean, the Dodgers are going to win that division. I don't often say that on opening day, but I don't see any way around that. Diamondbacks look better than the Padres on paper, and so I think that's a possibility. I would say that's the most likely guy to go at the deadline at this point.
So we know how great the Dodgers are going to be. We understand the payroll issues, all the rest of it that they've put together. A team of superstars. They have depth. It's just extraordinary. They seem like they're injury proof, if that's a thing. Who's next? I mean, you know, you mentioned six teams in the NL. Are you a Atlanta guy, Philadelphia guy? Who would be next? The Mets? Who is it?
Well, I think the NL East is probably flip a three-way coin. You could pick see any of those teams doing it. I mean, by the end, I think the pitching of the Phillies looked outstanding. Christopher Sanchez looks like a potential Cy Young winner, and combine him with Nolan Wheeler, so I can certainly see the Phillies winning that. I mean, I think the Diamondbacks are probably the second-best team in that league. Now, they're not going to win the division, but you add Burns to Gallen and all the other pitchers they have, it's a pretty formidable team in their offense, at least produced, you know, in the top two in baseball last year. So I kind of like the Diamondbacks as the second best team, but I'm going to say the Cubs win the Central, and I think all three teams in the East make the playoffs, and they all win around 90 games, but they all make the playoffs.
You know, John, Mully's right. The Dodgers do look injury proof, but are they illness proof? Mookie Betts,
that's so weird.
Is such a strange illness. Now he's down to under 160 pounds. You wonder what his fitness level will be when he starts to recover. Where does he stand, and how big of a loss might that be, even to a team as good and deep as the Dodgers?
Yeah, I mean, obviously Mookie Betts is one of the top five players in the game. Just an amazing guy. Can play center, can play right, can play short, and just a great, great hitter with shocking power for a guy who normally weighs 180 pounds. You're right, he was down to 150-something. I think he's improving, though. I think he's getting better. I'm not a doctor. I'm just following it along like everybody else. And it sounds like he's getting better, and we're hopeful that he'll be okay. Yeah, they are pretty much injury-proof. They do have injuries. Last year, their rotation was decimated, and that was a shell of itself, and they still won the World Series in five games, and now they've added Sasaki and Snell. Kershaw looked great, at least on the sideline in spring training. I mean, to add Kirby Yates as a middle reliever, I mean, they've got five guys who can close there, counting a couple who are right now on the injured list, including your old friend Kopech, who's now a star. Everybody who goes there becomes a star. I will give the White Sox this. They did not trade Garrett Crochet to the Dodgers a year ago when the Dodgers were offering Gavin Lux and River Ryan. That would have been a disaster. They did much better with Teal Montgomery. So give the White Sox credit. They made a nice trade with Crochet. You know, obviously it's not going to be their year this year, probably even next year, but you know, it's a good sign that they've stopped trading with the Dodgers.
I pick Crochet to win the Cy Young.
Yeah, could be. I mean, an incredible talent, amazing arm. You know, I saw MLB Network had him ranked one person sixth, one eighth in baseball, which, I mean, obviously you can't rank him with Derek Skubal or Wheeler or probably even Skeens at this point. But in terms of the arm, the talent, certainly a top 10 pitcher in baseball. But, hey, look, the White Sox did well making that trade, waiting on it. And I think Teal's going to be a good player. Montgomery's got a chance. So give them credit for that at least, I guess.
John, let's zoom out for a second, because I think when you look around Major League Baseball today, opening day, and you see two teams opening their seasons, playing home games in minor league parks with the Rays in Tampa, and you have the A's in Sacramento. And for different reasons, I'm not sure how alike or similar or different they are, but is there a lesson to be learned for teams that might be searching for new stadiums or ballparks? And is there any takeaway from these two teams to learn lessons that maybe they should have known going in?
Yeah, I mean, the Rays have just blown it. You got to face it. They've had four chances to figure out the stadium. Both Pinellas and Hillsborough County in Tampa Bay area have given them opportunities and made deals with them. The Rays have backed out of the deals. They were eligible to back out of the deals. I mean, the hurricane opened things up there and changed a few things, and they just could not get a deal done. They did not ingratiate themselves with the politicos down there, but still they wanted the team to stay. They've done a good job on the field, considering they don't spend anything. It's amazing how many, the number of games they're able to win without spending almost anything. But in terms of getting that stadium done, they have not been able to do it, and I probably took time for that team to sell. Oakland, I mean, you know, I felt like, you know, they kind of tore the team down when they were there and, you know, kind of forced this trade. So I don't like it, but MLB is giving them a pass and saying, you know what, change in politics out there prevented a new stadium, and this is the best solution. And, you know, I don't know. I think ownership was a problem in both places, and it certainly continues to be in Tampa, and they're probably going to have to figure out a new owner, because the MLB wants to stay in Tampa. They do not want to move. I don't know. Maybe I don't know whether the owner in Tampa, Stu Sternberg, wants to move. It's hard, unclear what he wants to do, because he keeps changing his mind and changing deals, and I don't know. But the best thing is for them to do is to sell the team now and keep the team in Tampa.
What an absolute oddity that there are two major league ball clubs playing in minor league parks. It's like crazy.
Bad look.
Yeah, I mean, well, it's happened before where it's one, but not two. No. It's pretty ugly, and you know, in Tampa, it's, you know, a nice community and all that, but they're gonna have a rain delay in probably 2/3 of the games in Tampa. They're changing all the timing of the games and all these things, but it rains there almost every night during the summer, so it's not gonna be. They fixed it up beautifully. The Yankees have, you know, I don't know if it was out of their generosity or what, they did get a little bit of money for it, and they did fix up their own spring training facility nicely. They got some positives, but I mean, George Steinbrenner never would have let the Rays, I don't think, play games at his field, the George M. Steinbrenner field. But, you know, I guess good for Hal that it's the best thing for baseball that's where they're going. I mean, it's certainly better than playing in Dunedin or one of the other parks down there. It also rains in Dunedin, obviously, and that park is not the same. This is a nicer facility, so give the Yankees, you know, at least a speck of credit for allowing this. But yeah, it's not great that they're in a park for 10,000 people. The good news is they only draw 18,000 on average anyway. It's not the Dodgers having to cram into a 10,000-seat park where you have 50,000 fans coming every day. This is the number of fans that they do have in Tampa.
Well,
you know,
here in Chicago, that will be the backdrop to the White Sox season, obviously with rumors and reports about the ballpark in the South Loop and Justin Ishbia's involvement and interest, all those things, John. But any glimmer of hope on the field revolves around, or seems to, Will Venable, the new manager, bright guy, made a good, strong impression in spring training. And yet, I don't think that reasonable people look at the Sox season and think that they can avoid a 100-loss season.
John, they might be worse on paper because they don't have any pitching.
You could argue that they're worse opening day this year than they were last year at this time on paper. But what do you expect from the White Sox?
Yeah, I mean, they look worse on paper, but could they possibly be worse on the field? I mean, I think it would be impossible, right? Yeah. They were the worst team of all time last year, basically, arguably the worst. So I don't think that's possible. It's nice that they have a manager who seems to be, you know, have the potential to be a very good manager. But, I mean, let's face it. I mean, Bruce Bochy, Miller Huggins, whoever you want to call him, I'm dating myself with that. Joe McCarthy, whoever, Francona, nobody could turn this team into even a 70-win team. It would be impossible. So you can't really have any expectations here in terms of the number of wins. I will say, beyond the manager, they do have some prospects. I mean, they're no longer near the bottom on the prospect list, and I think it's fair now. You've got Schultz, potentially. He's got the potential. Now, he has never gone long in any games, right. So no given here. But he's got potential. You got Hagen Smith, potentially a good player. They acquired Teal, should be a very good catcher long term for the team from the Red Sox in that Crochet deal. You still got Robert, who is another good trade candidate, but he's going to have to prove it at least over a half a season. He was terrible last year, frankly. And so, I mean, they have some good young players and prospects, I should say. And, you know, look into the future. It'll be brighter than it is now. How bright, I can't predict.
I find it interesting that you got the Mets in Houston, because I think both those teams have a pretty compelling story. You know, it feels like Houston's kind of rebuilding. They started the season 7-19, something like that, and they went on to win the division. And I saw Pecota has them like within two games. There's three teams there that they all have close to the top of the division. And then you look at, you know, obviously the Mets. Is Soto worth the money? Does he turn everything in their favor?
Yeah, is anybody. I mean, $765 million. Let's remember that Ohtani got a deal that's worth basically $465 million. So $300 million less for a guy who brings in hundreds of millions of dollars in sponsorship. You know, we're talking about a guy who pays for himself. This contract is way out there, but, you know, the Yankees, who had him for a year, believed he was worth about that. They'd offered $760 million. Maybe they weren't going to give that signing bonus, the luxury suite. There were a few differences, but there were at least two teams that were willing to pay in that range, and I think two others that were in the $700 million range. So, you know, I think the superstars have this huge value to teams in terms of the cachet and selling tickets and whatever. I mean, Ohtani's on a different level, but in that next group, you've got Soto, Judge, and Vladimir Guerrero Jr., who the Jays absolutely have to sign. But as far as the Mets go, that lineup looks great. They're missing their second baseman, their catcher, who are out. Injuries are decimating teams all over as we start, but the lineup looks fantastic. Soto is an all-time great hitter. I do believe that. Is he worth $765 million? You know, I don't know. I'm not an economist, but two teams thought so. So,
John, in the final minute we have, how surprised are you that Luis Robert Jr. is still on the White Sox, and what kind of market could you see developing for him if he stays healthy?
Not surprised at all. I mean, you know, he had a terrible year last year. You know, you sell a stock when it goes down to two. You know, I mean, he couldn't do that. You know, I mean, they weren't going to get any decent offer for a guy. And that contract was looked at as such a bargain, but now that $20 million a year off of the year that he had last year, it's hard for a team to justify giving up any really good prospect. And teams don't like to trade prospects anyway, so he's going to have to put together a half year. I know he had a year in the past. We had with 38 home runs. He's been Gold Glove caliber in the past. If he can do that for half a year, he will be worth a lot more than that contract, and they will be able to get a great prospect for him. But not surprised at all. I did not expect them to trade him.
John, you're the best. Thank you, buddy. A lot of fun. Perfect
guest.
All
right, happy opening day. Great talking to you guys.
Enjoy it, John. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thanks.
That's the guy to talk to on opening day.
Oh, you got
to
love it. Yeah, great perfect. Insight.
Hey, Tim, how you doing?
I'm good, fellas. It's always a pleasure for my annual Get Rich with Mully and Hall.
It's always good to catch up with you. And obviously, our mutual friend Dustin Rhodes arranges this. So always a joy from my days when I was at Sporting News Radio.
The Wonder Grump is always upset, but he always calls me. So I guess we're still getting along.
I don't know how you do it. So, Tim, help us out. Who do you like to win this tournament? Who has caught your eye? I mean, we said going in there might be six teams, but how many are possibly winning the championship, in your opinion?
Well, I like Auburn. I just think they're the most complete team, and I also think it's Bruce Pearl's time. I think navigating the different stages, the different plateaus that you have, I do think coaching does matter in times like these. Tom Izzo, I feel similarly about, but I think the issue for him is Ole Miss is sort of like playing, it's sort of like playing Pearl, because Chris Beard's been there and done that too. And Ole Miss plays a lot like Michigan State plays. So that's an incredible matchup. We got great matchups all across the board. I do think, and I want to just serve this up first and foremost for you guys, if you don't mind, there is so much inadequacy and inaccuracy on college athletics, on sports media today, particularly on the daytime Embrace Nothing debate shows that are on. They don't cover the college game at all until Selection Sunday. And when they do, they make fools of themselves. To say that Cinderella is dead and the tournament has lost its luster because we don't have a true Cinderella. What the hell is Arkansas? They started 0-5. Just because they're Arkansas and Cal's coaching, if you look at the number next to their name, I'd say that's a hell of a run. That's a hell of a slipper story. You know, years ago, Dale Brown took a team to the Final Four as an 11 seed, and he had been to the Final Four in 81. He was still a Cinderella in 86. What the hell's – why can't Arkansas be considered a Cinderella? Colorado State could have very easily beaten Maryland, and they would be a Cinderella. So to say that the games are not as competitive and because of NIL and the portal, this thing's going in the tank, that is such a crock of – fill in the blank, okay?
I don't know, Tim. It's
absolutely absurd. Yeah. The people making these statements cover the NBA, okay? The people that are saying that, oh, by God, Derrick Queen took four steps. What the hell has LeBron been taking for the last 20 years in the NBA? I am sick and tired of being sick and tired of people that weigh in on college athletics for three blanking weeks that don't know jack about squat, having a platform to demean everything college. If it's a college event, we'll go after it. We're not going to go after the NBA. Nobody's watching the NBA. Their ratings are in the tank. Millions and billions of dollars are being spent on a sport that's not serving its audience very well at all, so much so to the point that ratings don't seem to matter. And yet we've got the best ratings ever in college athletics, and all we want to talk about is how corrupt it is. It makes me sick to my stomach.
Wow. I respect your passion. I don't necessarily agree that the mid-major
Chicago, I get it. I
don't think that's fair either, Tim.
No, that's
honestly
what it is, fellas. That's what it is.
Well, okay,
absolutely what it is. Well, you know, I'm in a flyover state. I'm in the part of America that's red. You're in a part of America that's blue. And we don't see eye to eye on politics or sports, okay? Bottom line, that's what it is. And that's being infused into the daily rhetoric, and it makes me sick.
Well, I'm sorry, it makes you sick, and it didn't bring you on here to argue with you. But
to throw the college game under the bus the way it gets thrown under the bus on a daily basis on all forms of media is egregious, and it happens every year at this time.
Well, I mean, here's the problem. You know, how much money did they pay Cal? How much money did they give him to put a team together? Think about it, Tim. How many guys came into that program? How many new players? I'm sorry, but I can't fit the slipper on Cal's foot.
Okay. All right. Well, how many guys were sweating and toiling for all those years to help make those coaches and those programs all of the money that they have and all the amenities that they have?
Totally agree.
And get those players a couple of years away. So the fact that name, image, and likeness is and the transfer portal is part of the equation is because of grandiose old people that wanted to keep all the money for themselves because there's some neo-colonial outfit that's been living off the work of others for years. It's called the NCAA, and that's why we're where we are today. The schools themselves and the players themselves had nothing to do with the fact that all of a sudden now they actually have a chance to make some money. And the fact that it's not regulated is indeed a problem.
Yes.
Yeah, we've got issues,
yes.
No question about it.
Yes.
That's a separate issue altogether. What I'm saying to you is your feelings towards that influence and impact your view of how precious this event really is.
Well, but two things can be true, Tim. You can love and still watch the tournament and appreciate all the drama from the programs that remain in it in the Sweet 16 beginning tonight.
That's not the narrative all day.
Can I finish a thought? Can I finish a thought?
Go ahead.
Okay. Thank you very much. What I spoke of Monday morning, like other people who do love college sports, you can't assume that we don't just because we live in Chicago. I'm only here because I was a college athlete. Tim, let me finish.
I've been in the business for 40 plus
years.
And
I respect that. Right. And we respect you.
Okay.
But let us finish here. The lack of the mid-major was missing from my perspective because colleges, it's harder to have the Butlers and the Valpos and the Southern Illinois because what they do typically, Drake, they develop players for other programs, larger programs. So you have the Arkansas, which is a collection of other players who are using the transfer portal to their advantage. That's what we miss.
Right.
We miss the nostalgia things. You can miss that and still appreciate the tournament. Don't tell us what we don't, what we are, how we're feeling about something when you really are. That's not a fair assumption by you.
Okay, if you're thinking that I'm generalizing and painting with too broad a brush, you have that right. Okay, good. You can feel that way. But there are also great players at bigger schools that have used the NIL and moved down so that they can get more playing time and have an opportunity to produce and get a chance to maybe play at another level. They're looking out for themselves as well, and I get that. That's part of it. But that Colorado State game was great. Yeah, they lost. Drake was a team that I thought would get through, and yeah, they lost.
Yep.
I think anyone that has followed my career understands how much I have always been for the so-called little guy. You know, the BCS I crucified because it did what? It hurt the little guy. And, yeah, what's going on to some extent has hurt mid-majors, no question about that. But it's not as if mid-majors don't have the chance to compete. They can, and, yes, NIL is part of what they're attempting to do as well. We've got a lot to fix, fellas. We got a lot to fix. But what I'm telling you is, when I turn on cable television, whether it's FS1 or ESPN, okay, I'm hearing the same kind of trash on a daily basis. And they never really want to talk about the game. It's never how competitive was that game. How great was that game between St. John's and Arkansas? How great was that matchup that Colorado State gave us against Maryland? Yeah, okay, the mid-major lost, but my God, it was competitive. Those kids, whether they're making some money off NIL or not, they're defending. They're not playing Matador defense like we see on a daily basis in the NBA. And yet all we see nationally on cable television is the same gobbledygook every stinking day. And when something good happens in college, let's find something wrong with it. That's what's happening on a daily basis in national media. Now, specifically, I got a little hard on you because every time I go on a station in New York, a station in Chicago, a station in Baltimore, a station in D.C., I get the same kind of rhetoric from people. You know why? Because they don't cover the college game on a regular basis. They pay attention along about the time Selection Sunday rolls around. The sport's been going on for 4 months, and nobody seemed to care. They don't know how games were played in mid-November that helped teams get in the tournament, and people are bitching and moaning about a team getting in, but they have no idea who they played or what their non-conference schedule looked like. This goes on a daily basis, and yet it is part of the volume that keeps these major companies like the one I work for and like the one I used to work for alive and well. So, yeah, I'm going to fight for what I think is right. And when people look down their noses at the college game and find nothing but corruption, nothing but something wrong with it, well, I'm gonna push back, and I'm going to push back hard.
I just FYI, okay, I went to Loyola of Chicago, which made the Final Four 7 years ago, and went to the game.
Great story.
I still watch the Missouri Valley because I watched it for so long. I watch the A-10 now, and I look at those teams, and I see it. And Loyola just won last night in the NIT, and I'm following their progression through that tournament. So I think that what I'm looking at, Tim, from my perspective as a fan of a program, is that we got a young center there. A kid can jump out of the gym. Who knows? Maybe someday his name is
Miles
Rubin. Miles Rubin. And we talked to the coach yesterday. He said several times that the kid's not going to leave because of money, because they've given a contract to the guys that they want to bring back, and they're trying to keep them, and unprecedented amount of money. The way he was talking about it makes me feel like that kid's going to get transferred, right? And I think that is the problem for most mid-major schools. And so we talk about it through our own perspective and experience, and we're not bad-mouthing college sports. I'm glad the kids are finally getting money. I think that's good. But I also think...
But you can hear the concern in the coach's voice.
Exactly. We're in the wild, wild west.
This is the challenge they face that they didn't face 10 years ago, 5 years ago.
And we're not bad-mouthing it, but it's different and it's tough.
Right. We're talking apples and oranges here, fellas. My discussion, based on the opening question here and that you brought up, again, got me going, because I still believe there's more right than wrong about NIL in the portal. The young man Brakefield, who came in from a major city and transferred in to play at Ole Miss, brought a kid, a special needs kid, with him, and had the money generated from Ole Miss that he could afford to bring him, and he got it cleared with Chris Beard before he brought him. There are some amazing stories out there that players that are doing really good things with the $500,000 or maybe a little bit more that they're getting to go play at some of these major schools. So it's not all bad. The issue, though, becomes how easy the narrative is for those that live in a hot take sports media world. It's so easy to throw the game under the bus when, in fact, it's the people that governed it that put him in this spot.
But we didn't do that, though.
Yeah, we didn't do that.
We never did that.
But there are 35 conferences in college basketball, and 4 are represented in the Final 16, including one, Duke, the only one from the ACC. What we're noticing is that there had never been fewer than 7 conferences in the tournament.
It's more homogenous than ever.
And now, exactly what David said. And so the little guy, the guys from the mid-major school that I went to, they are not able to do those surprise runs, these magical, because, and again, Arkansas doesn't count because of Cal and the money.
Yeah. Well, sure, but I mean, Colorado State damn near won that game. I mean, they could have very easily won that game. It's not that they suddenly aren't competitive, because they are. It just so happened that the big conferences won. And by the way, when you get 14 in, as the SEC did, you shouldn't be shocked that 50% of them, got to the second weekend, which they did. So that's part of it. The NCAA is talking. We don't need to suddenly expand the tournament because of that. That would be a huge mistake. I mean, we've got the right number. The postseason is in fine shape. We need to fix the regular season. We need to move the calendar. In college basketball, it needs to be moved up and back. We don't need to be hurrying to finish college basketball before the Masters begins. That's an outdated thing, all right? Turner's paying 80% of the freight anyway. So, we don't have to hurry now to get the azaleas to bloom and to watch the pristine setting at Augusta National. And by the way, I love golf.
Sure.
Underground knows that, too.
Yep.
We need to start college football 2 weeks earlier, and we need to eliminate spring football altogether. We don't need the college game to be going up against wild card playoff games and divisional playoff games. Let's move the calendar needs to move back in football, and it needs to move forward in basketball. College has got a lot of issues right now, and the first and foremost thing it needs to do is have the conference commissioners take control of their product. And I think that's what both Tony Petitti and Greg Sankey are attempting to do. And I do think they have more than just their own constituency in mind now. And I've been critical of the big boys for many, many years when they only considered their chosen few. And, you know, the Neanderthals that govern the BCS. I said it how often? You know, the BCS World in Crisis Countdown. I said it how often? I've been pounding the pavement on this for the better part of my entire career. So you're preaching to the choir when you're talking about the little guy.
Right,
me,
right. Right.
But what I'm saying to you is, don't tell me that suddenly this event has lost its luster solely because there's seven SEC teams and four Big Ten teams, and you know, Duke is Duke, and they're in, and then the Big 12's got their fair share.
Tim, thank you. We're out of time.
Thanks
for
your passion. We got to go.
We love your passion, and thanks for the argument. Appreciate it. That's Tim Brandt.
This tournament down to 16 teams. College Hoops coverage on The Score brought to you by Bet365.
That was fun, David. Way to go after him. Way to fight back.